Good. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the actual good morning. All right. Welcome to MVP Days in Edmonton. My name is Philip Elder. I am an MVP, Microsoft's most valued professional. Hello to all of you out there. This is actually the first time for me as well, having a camera in front of me as well as live folks. I've been an MVP since 2009, started out on Small Business Server. We started building Hyper-V based solutions in 2008. Our first cluster was built on an Intel modular server, which is not in this particular image. This is a shot of some of the stuff that we built over the last year to year and a half, just a couple of bits and pieces. Our focus over the last little while, I'd say since about 2009, 2010, has been building clusters as a primary focus, high availability. The little guy in the middle there with the data on DNS 1640, JBOD, with the orange, kind of orange strip in the middle, that's actually sitting at a 15-seat client that is an accounting firm, very conscious of uptime. This is tax season, so any downtime at all during this time of the year costs them thousands of dollars an hour. So the cluster was a no-brainer. That's actually the second cluster that we delivered into their site. The one on the far right, bright blue there, that's just shy of half a petabyte of storage for one of our clients in the US who does a lot of now 4K video, and they needed a static place to put all of their archival data. They do use the data on a regular basis. It's a storage basis parity setup, and they're able to pull it back onto a 10 gigabit network and get the data files that they need to work with them, and then put them back all in. So in the last couple of years, especially since 2012, our focus has been Hyper-V and storage spaces. And that is our primary, yep, okay. So a question for you guys is, as I take a deep breath to get a little bit of my nerves here, who all works with storage spaces in Hyper-V? Hyper-V? A few of you. VMware? Oh boy, this is a VMware house. How many of you are independent or working for an independent IT firm of some sort? Providing services? How many of you are employed by a company that you got a specialty in storage and that kind of stuff? Okay, so kind of a 50-50. Our company's been around since 2003. My wife and I incorporated our company then, decided we're gonna go out on our own, and we've been doing pretty dang good, especially in the last couple of years since we found a little niche with folks who need high availability and cloud-like experiences, but they want it on premises. They want their data in the house. They don't want it out there somewhere. They don't want it anywhere else. So that's been our high focus over this last little while. So the focus of this talk is going to be on bottlenecks. Rule number one, when it comes to any kind of solution set, know your workload. There's a brick right there. I can remember one of the MVP sessions I did, I think last year, talking to a gentleman who was talking about a brick. It was a seven-figure brick. A seven-figure brick, okay? So let's talk about this for a moment. A lot of folks know how to sell something, but how many people actually know how to sell something, a solution set that's actually going to meet a need? So I make a promise and I deliver on that promise. Know your workload. That's the first bottleneck. First bottleneck's right here. We as a company have a point of principle. We only deliver solutions that we've built ourselves, that we've tested ourselves, and that we've figured out the bugs, the ups and the downs. If you're looking for a little bit of a broader experience as far as who else out there has done something like that, Microsoft has. Look up the CPS, the Cloud Platform System, that was a combination of Dell product and Microsoft product. And it's a solution set that goes into a one to many racks. And it basically uses some of the technology that we've adopted as well. So the first side of things is, know your workloads. What are your VMs doing? When are they doing it? How are your users experiencing whatever they're doing? So there's another side of that as far as talking to the users and seeing who's happy with what and who's not. And it's usually the ones that aren't happy that are going to speak out the most. and express their misgivings about the situation. So IOPS, your amount of information flowing back and forth across your bus. When is it happening? Throughput. When the storage solution gets set up, there's two ways to look at it. The blue solution that we have is set up so that we can pull close to a gigabyte a second across a 10 gigabit network. The storage stack can be set up, though, to go the other way, where we might need more IOPS. You can't have one, you can't have both. You can't have IOPS and you can't have throughput together. It's going to be one or the other or a combination thereof. There's a correlation. It's kind of an inverse curve. So if we need IOPS, we make our storage configuration smaller. So our blocks, our slices, whatever we're using for underlying interleave on storage spaces, everything gets smaller. How many of you guys, you folks here, work with SQL databases? What's your block size? On average, what's the block size you're setting up on your storage? 64 kilobytes. It's a compromise because you're getting a lot of 4K writes, 8K writes, 4K reads, 8K reads, but you're also getting some larger block sizes. So 64 kilobytes is the right size as a rule for anything when it comes to higher I/O. And that's the bottom of that bell curve. If we're in a situation where everything is all 4K, 8K, then we're going to start pushing towards a smaller. Maybe we'll do a 32 kilobyte block size and our entire storage stack will be set up that way. That goes to this end. And then on the other side, if we need throughput, such as large files, 4K files, we're going to do 256 kilobyte. We're going to do 512. We might even go all the way to our disk sizes now, which is 4 megs. 4 kilobytes, 4 megs. Anyways, a little bit jumbled. So know your workloads. OMS, we're talking about the time of day, getting an idea of how things perform over the week, over the month, over the year. Well, we need to know a little bit more about when's HR running their reports, when CXO is running their reports, when are folks doing payroll, when are folks putting a lot of load on the system, at what point during the day, week, month are these types of situations happening? And we need to be there to get all of our baselines. Rule number two, don't trust the vendor. The vendor tells you their application has 23,000 IOPS in its peak and they're all 4K writes. Verify. And I suggest keep the verification data to yourself. Share it depending on your relationship with the vendor, but we keep that data to ourselves as part of our pool of knowledge. And if we're going to share it, it's a part of the consulting services that we offer. There's also some clauses with some of the vendors out there that say you're not allowed to publish the performance results of everything you guys do. We're kind of gray on that. Okay. The other side of it is what's the fabric that's in between storage and compute? So storage and compute, we can have all flash storage on one side and we can have E5 2699 V4s on this side with a terabyte of RAM in there. But a gigabit fabric in between, obviously, that's not really going to work. So many of us, I'm sure, can talk about the brick. The solution set, the chief financial officer calling the vendor and saying, get your stuff out of my rack. I don't want it here. That's it. We've had it. And we know from some of the consulting gigs we've done, solution sets that are in seven figures where the client has finally said, I've had enough, I want it gone, get it out of here. And we were brought in to help them transition to a different solution that was gonna work for them. So anyone here into Star Trek? Sort of, no, yeah? The engineer's rule, promise two, do it in one. And it's the same thing when it comes to our solution set. Promise two, do it in one. Promise 100,000 IOPS, give them 200,000 IOPS. Promise them 4 gigabytes per second, give them 8, maybe 6. But always over-deliver on the promises and commitments that we make as far as our solution sets are concerned. Pardon me. So let's talk a little bit about the actual performance bottlenecks. How many of you have seen what happens when you have a 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 node cluster, and two or three of them have slightly different BIOS settings? Those two or three different units, when we've got data moving to, everything seems to work just tickety-boo. Everything just seems to flow just nice. As soon as anything comes off those units, so the ones that have the different settings, we've got a problem. All of a sudden, we're at 20% performance. So we're expecting, let's say, 1.5 gigabytes of throughput, maybe 10, 15,000 IOPS. But all of a sudden, when everything's coming off, we're getting about 10 to 15%. The C states, so the list there, the C states, off. That's the sleep states for the different cores inside the processor. And there's no communication between the processor and the operating system, necessarily, when it comes to sleeping the cores. So all of a sudden, we've lost half of our cores. But the operating system's sitting here going, well, wait a sec, I need more. And it's just, sorry, you got half. So we end up with a steep reduction in performance. Make sure your firmware and all your systems are up to date before you deploy your solution. Once you deploy your solution, there's a question mark there. Some folks are all, yeah, we're just going to keep deploying new firmware as the revs come down the board. I take a conservative approach. Once it's in production, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Unless there's a very specific reason for updating the firmware on that solution set. A very specific reason. One would be data loss. And we've seen that with firmware on RAID controllers, SAS host bus adapters. We've seen issues that we've had to go in and actually update firmware on the fly. There's some pretty good mechanisms some of the tier one folks have as far as updating firmware, but we've seen enough bricks post deployment where the firmware actually contradicts or is contra to what's going on in the system, and that's why I've got README text. Read the README text. Read the caveats. Read the bugs that the new firmware is going to introduce. Remember, what is firmware? Anybody?
Software.
It's software. It's an operating system, essentially. It's an operating environment for every component in the server. Drives have firmware. RAID controllers have firmware. NICs have firmware. Motherboards have firmware. Baseboard management controllers, which should never be plugged into the internet directly, have firmware. So everything is a piece of firmware. Now, if we're all best buds and we're all sitting down having a beer or a drink or whatever together, all of us here, and we're chatting away, are we all going to be talking about the same thing? Probably not. Now, it comes time for all of us to choose one movie to go to. Good luck with that, right? There's a few of us that are going to go, I don't want to see Rogue One. I don't want to go see Boss Baby. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. But a group, there will be a core of us that will. Firmware operates very similarly. So when we fit a solution together, and we get the magic combination where everybody in this room wants to go see Rogue One, we're sticking with it. We're happy with it. And that solution, so long as it's never touched, never moved, and it keeps running for 5 years, is happy. So, firmware, make sure it's all up to date. Read the READMEs. Find out from the vendors if there's any serious caveats, because believe me, there will be serious caveats in there somewhere. It's a complicated bit of software. Storage. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we've got IOPS, we've got throughput, we've got NVMe, SSD, and hard drive. How many are running NVMe type solutions in your systems now? Anybody? No. Can anybody tell me what the one caveat with deploying NVMe in a solution set is? It's a very important caveat. Anybody? I heard the word.
No redundancy.
No RAID. No nothing. So NVMe currently is great in vSAN or storage spaces direct because the platform fault domain is the server. And if I have two, we usually put two or three 3700s in our S2D nodes. S2D is an acronym for storage spaces direct. So we'll put two or three depending on the ratio to capacity storage that we need. There's NVMe fabric, over fabrics coming up here in the next little while, and NVMe redundancy. That's coming down the pipe as well, okay? That's all fine and dandy. What's the limitation to all of this? Anybody? It's the bus. Intel is still stuck on PCI Express version 3, and version 4 is still a few years out, and that's already too small. So we're in a situation now where our storage is very robust, but our bus and the ability to get the data from storage into whatever it is we're processing is very limited. So we have three tiers on the storage side. We have all flash solutions, which a number of the vendors who have been represented here at MVP days in the past have deployed. We've deployed. Your IOPS on the storage solution and throughput and or throughput. The next step after that is how we get that data into our platform, our solution set. Okay, and that's the bottom bullet point there, fabric. What do we do about our fabric? What do we do to get the data either from storage to compute? How many of you are running iSCSI? A few of you, Fibre Channel? Quite a few of you are running. Fibre Channel guys, 16 gigabit, 32 gigabit, 8?
Still 8.
8? Lower than 8? Okay, so we're at the entry level, mid-level now, what would be called entry to mid-level of Fibre Channel. Fibre Channel is one of the best ways to get data between storage and compute, but there's one very important caveat. It's extremely expensive, extremely sensitive, and requires a very solid knowledge base, right? You need a pretty good team of folks to manage that stuff. You got switching, you've got protocols, you've got all sorts of things. There's a few aspects to it. So we get into the fabric side of it as far as what happens between compute and storage. For us, when we're deploying a smaller set, so just a standard JBOD clustered storage spaces, or scale-out file server, so it's storage spaces, we have a 10 gigabit, 410 gigabit paths per server using SMB multi-channel. So we actually get 40 gigabits. Of course, we have Ethernet latencies and Ethernet issues to deal with as well. But for the most part, it's stable. We've got small hosting companies running anywhere from 30 to 200 VMs on that solution set. So we know it works pretty well. But it doesn't work very well for higher IOPS, right? So as soon as we get into the position where we have to start pushing our fabric into a higher IOPS solution, Ethernet's just not going to cut it. iSCSI's, it works, it's all right, but it's just not going to cut it when we need a little bit more. A lot of folks are still running gigabit as their iSCSI platform for storage, sometimes a single switch. Every solution set requires two paths between compute and storage. Two paths. Redundancy. That's a very important part of the solution set. Any questions? Any questions online? No?
You're doing a great job. Thank you for standing in one spot. Maybe I'll stand in one spot.
It's very difficult for me to stand still in the first place, so it's a bit of a challenge. So we can have our three NVMe PCI Express cards, 6 terabytes of NVMe. We can have another 20 or 30 terabytes of SSD. And then we can have our 40 or 50 terabytes of spinning rust. And then we have a 10 gigabit fabric between the two, between compute and storage. So we go and spend six figures on a beautiful stack of all flash storage or high performance storage, and we still have a 10 gigabit connection between them. The fabric between the storage and the compute is a very important part of our solution set, obviously. So for us, what we've started doing is we use Mellanox as our foundation, and that's Rocky is the RDMA fabric that we've chosen. So Rocky is RDMA over converged Ethernet. We have the option for 10 gigabit. That little guy right there that's a brand new switch that they've introduced, the 1012X. It's actually a dedicated 12 ports at 10 gigabit. So I can run RDMA. Does anybody know what RDMA does for your storage? No? Anyone ever supercharge a V8? No? NOS? I'm a car guy, right? So I know the difference between putting 8 pounds of boost and 24 pounds of boost and 40 pounds of boost and 75 pound shot, 150 pound shot. Okay, you put boost on an engine and all of a sudden you're sitting there going with your little Honda Civic, blah! You're screaming. Almost, it's four cylinders. V8's better, my not so humble opinion. So it's like dropping a supercharger on your four cylinder, your V8, whatever it is. It gives you a 15 to 20% boost in performance. The biggest boost is latency. IOPS, throughput, latency. Latency is always going to be your killer when any solution set is being examined. And that's where the vendors come in. So ask a vendor, how much latency can your application tolerate before it starts puking all over the place? And usually it's, I think I have to talk to an engineer. How many of you do know approximately how much latency is required before folks start complaining? Hands up. Anybody? We deploy, our solution sets are running under decent sized cloud providers. So they're providing remote desktop services, they're providing remote apps, all sorts of solution sets. 250 to 300 milliseconds is when we start hearing complaints. When we start seeing 200 plus milliseconds against the calls to storage, we know we're going to hear problems. We're going to hear complaints from folks. 200 to 300 milliseconds of latency is getting pretty freaking high. And we deliberately, again, we test everything we do. We deliberately push everything as far as we can to make sure we understand exactly what's going to happen. So what does that mean? RDMA takes a standard 10 gigabit solution set, 40 gigabits of pathway between the nodes and storage, and reduces that latency from 300 milliseconds to 100 or less. It's a lossless fabric. That's what RDMA is about. It was brought about to give us a way to bring data to the nodes and back again in as quick a time as possible, which is very difficult to do on Ethernet. It's not very difficult to do on fiber channel. It's expensive to do on fiber channel. So that little guy right there is about $4,000. The NICs, so you got two of those, you're at $8,000. The NICs are about $400 a piece, two per server. All right, we always run two paths, redundancy, very, very, very important. So at 10 gigabits, we can populate an 8-node storage space is direct, which is what the four nodes with the in the middle there are. We can populate a 4-node storage space is direct hyper-converged solution set for under $10,000. And we have 10 gigabits of lossless, no latency, virtually no latency throughput between the nodes. That's brain to brain, RDMA, direct memory access. That's brain to brain, okay? So the fabric that happens, we can have, again, the biggest box under the sun, seven figures flash through the yin-yang, and then all of a sudden, on the other side, we've got nothing because the fabric in between is not very good. Questions? How much time do I have? Hair past freckle? 20 minutes, so about halfway through. Anybody actually deployed a solution set from scratch to finish? You have? Anyone? No? Anyone here design as far as designing them? So a few of you have a design solution set. So I'm going to back up one step before I go on to the next slide, which isn't too much. How many of you guys are sitting with a problem that you don't know the solution to, as far as your solution set that you're working with? Anybody? Yes? No? Okay. So I'm going to back up one. I've lost my frame of reference and I apologize for that. Okay. So we've talked a bit about the hardware. We've talked a bit about the storage. We've talked a bit about the fabric. What about overcommit? Familiar with the principle of overcommit? Okay. When a virtual machine is assigned 4 virtual CPUs, so we give the VM 4 threads to pass through the bus. Does anybody know how those 4 threads are managed by the hardware to get through the bus? They basically go down together like this. Okay. In the CPU bus, your 4 threads are always going to travel in parallel. When we were building solution sets back in the day, do you remember the 3400 series Intel Xeons? There was a bug check that happened in 2008 R2, watchdog clock timer. Does anybody remember that one? We were burned by that. We deployed an Intel modular server solution set. We're talking a good 6 figures worth of hardware and software and a very, very important client, and we're getting bug checks. Does anybody remember what that was? Those 4 threads were going through the processor, and guess who kicked in? Turbo boost. All of a sudden, this one jumped ahead 1, 2, 3 bins, 4 bins. Bug check. Those 4 threads need to be processed in parallel. Guys, again, SQL databases? Yes, no? Okay. In a solution set, when we're hitting a limit, we know we've hit a performance limit, and we think, oh, we're going to throw more virtual CPUs at it. So we throw another 4, and now we've got 8. Does that really improve our performance? Not usually. Why? Let's take a simple processor solution that has four physical cores per CPU with 2 sockets, so 8 cores. Who here has driven the 401? The I-5 down between Los Angeles and San Diego, 16 lanes, right? Okay. This is how hyper-threading works. I'm on the I-5, the 401, I've got 4 lanes and 4 lanes. Pardon me. All of a sudden, I've got 8 lanes and 8 lanes. Woohoo! Traffic spreads out, things start moving, and then we have to merge back down to 4 again. Oh. Shoot. And we all love to merge around here, right? I don't know about you, but Edmonton, we have fun with merges. Learn to merge. Speed up, don't break. Yeah. Well, in the core logic system, there's a bit of a struggle there as well. Because that data has to merge back in. Okay. So we have 4 and 4, 4 processor, 4 cores and 4 cores, 4 physical cores and 4 physical cores. I'm having a hard time with my application, my workload's struggling, and I've got 4 cores already assigned. I go and assign 2 more. Now I'm running 6 threads, but I've only got 4 cores per processor. What happens to those 2? Anybody? Say again? Queue. Yeah, there's that, what Intel calls the quick path interconnect. I don't know what AMD, we haven't deployed an Opteron processor in 10 years. Okay, so they all come together. All of a sudden, dunk, these guys have to get shuffled over to the other processor. We just lost a bin. We just lost 1 cycle. Boom, they got to get into the processor pipeline together. But there's already several other VMs with 2 virtual CPUs, 1 virtual CPU, or even 3 queued for those pipelines. So now we're pausing. They're still here. They're not even in the pipeline yet. They're not even in the processor. They're in the queue. Then they start going dunk, dunk through the processor. Okay? So all of a sudden I went from, I'm really experiencing not so good performance to, oh my goodness, the CEO is going to kill me. Because my application just choked. Okay, so assigning more virtual resources doesn't necessarily equate to better performance. Our rule of thumb is n minus 1. If we have four cores, the maximum we're going to assign to a VM is 3. If we need more, then we buy a bigger box. We get 8 cores. Are you familiar with how Intel bins their processors? So if it's got a 3 or a 7 on the end, your gigahertz is higher and your core count is lower. So our preference is to go gigahertz over cores. The exception to that is when we're running an extra wide load, which would be something SQL oriented or database oriented. VDI bins, we want gigahertz. So we're deploying 67s and we're deploying 83s, 87s. So those are that's the processor line we tend to stick with. So we got gigahertz over cores. Okay, so those threads have worked their way through. Now, if we're looking at a solution set or a workload that's having a hard time with 4 threads, and we bump up to 6, let's say we have an 8-core processor, 8 and 8, and it's still struggling, what's the next thing we're going to do? Well, if it's struggling after we've given it more bins, then we know that there's something else going on in there, latency. Now, you guys working with databases know there's a lot more going on there under the sun than just IOs and CPU cycles. There's programming at work here, and there's sometimes a little bit of this as far as it's not my problem from the developer to the SQL admin who goes, my SQL databases are running just fine. And then there's us who's sitting there going, well, my latency and IO and everything, let me show you something. Everything's throughput, everything's good. Not going to happen. So in parallel, n minus 1, question.
Sorry, but that, just backtrack a little bit. When you said about the CPU cores,
yes.
You were counting the hyper-threading?
Not. So the question is, do we count hyper-threading? Coming back to that merge, you know, the 401 i5 example, we never count hyper-threading in any kind of performance. We never assign virtual CPUs that's going to push our physical CPU, which has 4 cores. We don't assign 6, because those 2 threads still have to be processed together. And at some point, they're going to come out, and they're going to merge back in again. And that's lost CPU cycles. That's hurt performance. Just leave it.
Just don't count them.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
So as far as the BIOS settings are concerned, we disable the C states, so that's the sleep states. High performance, make sure your fan settings are all high performance. Make sure your performance settings, some manufacturers just have, I want performance, or what is it called, EcoSmart or something like that, whatever the politically correct term of the BIOS days are today. So max it. Even if the machine's running at 35% today, max it. You don't want to change those settings down the road either. Okay? And a little extra heat in the data center isn't really going to make a big difference on the power bill either. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody familiar with NUMA? N-U-M-A? All right. So ask me what that means. I can't remember at the moment. It has to do with memory architecture. So in an Intel workload, in Intel setting, we have 2 NUMA nodes. There's 2 memory controllers on the entry to mid-level processors. When we start getting into the big ones with 20-some cores and that, they're starting to implement more memory controllers in the processor. So what ends up happening? We're in exactly the same place as we are with virtual threads, virtual CPUs, for virtual RAM. We need to be conscious of how much memory is available to each memory controller. Again, if we assign more virtual memory than is available on one NUMA node, there's one real impact and one possible impact. Real impact, it ain't going to work. It's juggling between memory controllers, whether that's between processors, as in the case of a 2633 or 37, 63, 67. Oh, Jimmy Cricket. I think it's 33 and 67. Okay. we start losing performance because it takes bin cycles for the memory to move around between nodes. We can do it just because we can doesn't mean we should. Okay? Now with 3-4 NUMA nodes in one system, we got to be very mindful. The second possibility is I've got a terabyte of RAM in my physical node. And I go to start my VM and it stalls. It doesn't even start. It says I'm not starting because there's not enough memory for me. If there's not enough memory in one of those NUMA nodes, depending on how much RAM is allocated across all the workloads running on that node, he ain't going anywhere. Hey, Sim, he's not going anywhere. He's going to stall. That's another aspect to memory that we need to be mindful of. I'm not as familiar with the VMware type setups, and I'll be straight with you. I tried. It took 9 months of my life to build my first Hyper-V cluster. It took another 3 months of my life to build a disaggregate because the documentation is bleh. It just stinks. And when somebody came along and said, we want to build a VMware cluster and we'd like you to do it for us. And I said, well, let me look into it. And after about a month, it's like, sorry, dude, it's not worth it. It was just too painful to try and figure out. But as far as VMware goes, as the hypervisor goes, there's VMware, there's Hyper-V, there's AVHD on Nutanix, there's a whole bunch of others now. There's Xen. The rules are essentially the same. If we overcommit on RAM, if we got dynamic memory, and all of a sudden something balloons and you run out of RAM, you're done. Your workloads are done. And we got somebody on the horn opening a ticket, okay? So, number of threads, amount of memory assigned to your VMs, your bus speeds are obviously an important part of that, so your processor speeds, your bin speeds, number of cores. Storage, the fabric between the storage is critical. It doesn't matter how big and bad and fast that box is with all flash, if I got a 10 gigabit fabric in between the two, it's not gonna work. So in our hyperconverged setup, we start off at the 10 gigabit on RDMA. Did you know, here's an example. I mentioned that the Mellanox switch is just around $4,000 each, and we deploy two of them. The least expensive 10 gigabit, 16 port switch out there is made by Netgear, and we've got it running a lot of fabric between compute and storage out there for our entry level scale out file server clusters to Hyper-V compute. They work great, but they're almost the same cost. Guess what? Bye-bye Netgear. We're deploying all RDMA now. We're deploying all Rocky because the cost-wise, the cost of the adapters is a lot less. An Intel 10 gigabit X540 is about $700. The Mellanox is $350, $400. So it makes they actually balance each other out. Questions? No? So the fabric that we start out with, 2-4 nodes on a hyperconverged solution, so vSAN, same thing. We start out at 10 gigabits, but it's RDMA. When we get to 6-8, we're gonna scale out a little bit. We're gonna do 25 gigabit. Mellanox has a nice 25 gigabit kit now. Or we're gonna do 50. When we start getting into, and this will be my last point because I think I'm pretty close to out of time. When we start getting into, you know, everyone's talking about 100 gigabit speeds, and everybody's all excited about 100 gigabit speeds. I put a dual port 100 gigabit Mellanox NIC into a PCI Express by 16 Gen 3, and I've only got two of them in my server, so I got two of those. Am I truly getting 100 gigabits per port? No. In an 8X, so a half-length slot, not a 16X, I can put a dual 56 gigabit Mellanox. Do I get the full 56 gigabits per port, the two ports? No. That's something else to keep in mind. It's all fine and dandy to put 100 gigabit pair of cards in there, but is it really gonna give it to you? Are you gonna get the value for your dollar today? Very questionable. Anybody work with Omnipath? Intel Omnipath? It's their answer to Ethernet and RDMA? No? We're trying to get them to send us some demo kit, but they want us to buy it. So I'm sitting here going, well, that's on the shelf because we've got other vendors who are more than happy to send us, like Mellanox would be more than happy to send us some 100 gigabit kit if we need it. So, any questions? No? Worth your time? Yeah, I hope so. Sorry I was a little scrambled. It's I need a little bit more caffeine, a little bit more go.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're welcome. Gentlemen, thank you, ladies, gentlemen, for your time.